For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Tonight's class, I had originally left 2 weeks ago, for those of you, or I think it was last week, actually, for those of you who are paying attention, I had intended on combining the two classes, the one that Rabbi Friedman was supposed to do, but as he mentioned last week, he didn't want to do, plus the one that we were supposed to have, and combine them all into one class, which was the divine nature of the written law and the oral law. So it turns out that that was a little bit too much to chew on. That was just an enormous amount of information and way more than I could possibly try to cram into an hour's time. So we're going to do just the written law tonight. And Rabbi Neuberger of Or Yisrael told me he's hoping to be able to do the oral law class, which he was originally hoping to do. We're just going to find the right week to do that. We're going to juggle with the free will that we're missing on December 8th. We're going to rearrange the schedule. You'll stick with us. Part of the essential nature of being a Jew is being able to go with the flow, make some adjustments. Things don't quite work out the way that you always planned on it. And so as part of our essentials class, we're going to have some real life exercises in that. And we'll work it out as we go along. Okay, how have I, all of our lives should be as easy to navigate as rescheduling some of these classes. All right. So tonight's class is going to be the divine nature of the written law, the Torah Shebichtav. This is a phrase known in Hebrew as Torah Misinai. The origin, the concept that the Torah that we have originates, comes from Sinai, comes from Mount Sinai, given to Moshe directly by God. And that is the concept. How do we know that this is true? What is our source? I have a typo on the first line of my notes, which is always embarrassing. Where did the Torah come from, and how do we know it should read? It's authentic. How do we know it's authentic? Here we are, keeping this word, living our lives according to the principles of the Torah. Where, how do we know that that which it says in the book is actually authentic? There are many religions out there in the world. Almost every religion has some form of a book that is its dictates, its guide, its divine word, and they're all very different. So who says, how do we know what we have is authentic? It's an important question, yeah? It's a pretty important question. So because I don't want to ease you into this, I'm going to go right for the jugular with our opening line, and I'm going to ask you the following question. How much does this question matter to you? How much does this question of the divine origin, the nature of Torah, being absolutely 100% divine, actually matter to you? And I'm going to ask you the following three questions, which I have on the sheets in front of you. I want you to actually answer this question. I don't need to know the answer. You need to know the answer. You can actually circle it on your sheets, put a little check mark, or just in your head if you don't want to actually put it on paper. It's fine. But here are your three options. Option number one, I am a fully committed Jew already, fully believing I'm in, hook, line, and sinker, every little detail. And I would love to be strengthened with some compelling proofs that I'm going to hear tonight. I'm looking forward to hearing it, but I'm in. I don't intend on actually doing anything more because I'm doing all that I can, or at least as much as the authenticity of Torah is concerned. But I'd like to hear some interesting proofs. That's option number one. Option number two, I am a mostly committed Jew. I'm in. I'm affiliated with an Orthodox synagogue. I do my best with Shabbos and kosher and Pesach and all the other laws that are entailed. But there's more that I can do. And I know that deep down, the reason why I'm not doing that extra step is because, you know, there's that little voice, I don't know how much of this is like really down to the detail, really. And that's where I am. I'm committed. I'm in. But if you can come at it, meaning you were saying to me, if you, Rabbi Freundorf, can give me some real good, compelling proofs, I'll do more tomorrow than I'm doing today because I'll have gotten rid of that voice in my head. That's option number two. Option number three is I'm really not committed. And the reason why I'm not committed is because I haven't been convinced that this is a divine truth, that the system that we are a part of is divine. And that's why I'm not fully committed. But if you can prove to me that this is divine, if you can prove to me that indeed this is the exact word of God, I will be a totally different person. That's a very serious question I just posed. To identify yourself, how serious is this question? Now, we don't necessarily always think about this question of the divine nature of Torah, but it's an important question. It's definitely an essential question. There's no question about that, that tonight we fulfill the concept of essentials. But how essential is it to you? Something that, well, I'm in, but I'd like to hear some proofs. I could do more, and the reason, the thing that's holding me back is that nagging voice. Versus, I'm not even in yet fully. I'm just waiting for somebody to prove it to me. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm saying about doing more because of the fact that I'm not convinced that this is truth. Every human being can be doing more, yes. That goes without saying. I'm talking about somebody who can identify that the nagging voice in my head is because, I don't know, is this really truth? Did he really say that? Does he really care? That kind of question. It's a serious question. It's a serious question. For those of you who actually do want to discuss this with me privately, you're welcome to send me an email, give a call. We can have lots of discussions. Question's going to be what we're going to come out with. What's tonight's class going to be about? Meaning, which person on that list am I going to address in tonight's class? Are you ready for an answer? Well, I mean, let's work this out. I mean, person number three who's not committed because you haven't been given. Anybody here think in the next hour I'm going to convince somebody of the divine truth of Torah? There's no way. There's no way. I mean, maybe an hour and a half, but definitely not an hour. Why not? Why am I not going to be able to convince somebody of that in an hour? It's more than time, right? It takes even more than time. For the same reason we discussed about convincing somebody of the existence of God, in terms of how can you prove something, what level of proof do you need to believe something, is really going to be the issue at stake. I'm going to skip a line in my notes and go down to C. How much evidence do you need to believe something? Let me start with this following question. Who here has been to China? Anybody here been to China physically? Two. Excellent. Okay. Small half. Three maybe. A couple of people. For everybody else in the room who has not been to China, let's assume that nobody here had actually been here, but do you believe that China exists? By a raise of hand. Now, none of you, you guys told me you've never been there. You've told me you've never been there, but you believe that it exists. So why do you believe that it exists? Right? Well, you've seen it on TV. Do you think people believed that China exists before 1900 who never visited and never saw it on TV? You think they believed it exists?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, they never saw it. Why do they believe that it exists if they were never there themselves? Okay, I can't pick up what you're saying because you're all saying something. I would probably sound something along the line. Yeah?
Because somebody else has been there.
Somebody else has been there. You know somebody who has been there. Or you look at the plethora of proofs that it exists, and you say, it can't be that every single map that's ever been drawn has China on it if it's not really true. It can't be that there are billions of materials that say printed on it made in China if there's no such place. It can't be that there's a team from the Olympics that represents a country that doesn't exist. There's just too much information, too many things out there that point to the reality that it can't be that somebody scammed the whole world. It's just too much. So even though I've never been to China, and I only had three people in this room who raised their hands and said, if he's been there, and I've seen it on CNN, and my mug says made in China, and there's a team in the Olympics, there's China. And I take that as fact. Do I believe that there's a place called China, or do I know that there's a place called China?
No.
I don't believe it. I know it, even though I've never been there. Because we've met people from China. It's a very interesting thing. How about the bubonic plague, the black plague? Do you believe that it took place, that it happened?
Yeah.
Did anybody here experience it? Did anybody here know somebody who lost a family member from the Black Plague? How do you know it's true? Let's think. It's the same reason. It can't be that the History Channel made up a documentary about it, right? Well, that is true. The History Channel could make up a documentary about it, but it can't be that they would make up a documentary about it, and that every single history book that has ever been written speaks about it, that it's become part of our vernacular, you could just mention it, and everybody knows what you're talking about. It can't be that all those things are out there. Which one of them would you point to and say, that's the proof, that's how I know it happened? None of them. It's, you take it as a whole, you take all the facts, all the references, all the places it comes up, and you say, it's true. Because it is. Not because of any one particular piece of information, because when you look at all the evidence points to one simple fact, that what's being discussed is a reality. That's a very important point that we're going to be talking about, because I will not come up with anything tonight. I will not tell you anything that you have never heard of before, I'm pretty sure. Maybe one or two things. Maybe. Maybe more. I don't know. I don't know what you guys know before, and I don't know. Whatever. We'll see. But I'm pretty confident as the speaker that there will be no one piece of information that you're going to point to and say, oh, Torah is true. God gave it to the Jewish people, and now that I heard that, I know it for a fact. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to share anything that's going to give you that impression. My goal is not to do so. My goal is to say, we're going to look at a lot of different facets. We're going to look at a lot of different angles. And when you put the facts together, you're going to say, this is as true as the existence of a place called China, even though I've never been there personally. I actually don't even know that I know anybody from China. But I know China exists because there's too much information that's just out there that is shared by everybody that says it can't be that it doesn't exist. So we're going to look at 7, I think is the number of what we'll come up with, different facets, different facts, different points that are going to point to something that will be clear to us, even though one of the 7 on its own might not do it for you, and it probably wouldn't, but it doesn't have to. We're going to look at it as a whole. So that's what this class is and what this class is not. Let's take a look at it together. Let's start, go back to letter B. So before we even get into proofs, well, what is it that we as Jews have to believe? What is our creed? What is the principle? So the Rambam, as we've quoted many, many times, has 13 principles of faith. The Rambam lists 13 different ideas. We've discussed a bunch of them. Here's, there are 4 that he discusses out of the 13 that have to do with tonight's topic. We'll just read them through. Number 6 out of the 13. Anima Amin, I believe with complete faith that all the words of the prophets are true. I'm going to read 6 and 7 together, we'll discuss. Number 7, I believe with complete faith that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, was true, and that he was the father of the prophets, both those who preceded him and those who followed him. Those are the 2 of the Rambam's principles of faith, that the words of the prophets are true, and that Moshe himself is the father, the Avi HaNaviim, the father of all Naviim, father of all prophets, bigger than those who came before him, meaning like Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and greater than all those who will come after him, like Isaiah and Jeremiah and the like. Why do you think these are so critical? Why is it critical that a Jew believes that Moshe is the father of all prophets and that the words of the prophets are true? Why can't I be a Jew without these 2? So the answer is similar, I'm sure, as you're all thinking or saying. Every religion, every religion, those that are true, like ours and others, have one simple problem, a theological problem, that it absolutely must address in a real way. And that is the divine, God, human beings, people. Big divide between them. If God indeed wants something from mankind, which is what we believe fundamentally is why we're here, well, what's the problem? How do we know? What do you want from me? You ever asked that question before? What do you want from me? What? What should I do? How should I live? Somehow, the divine must communicate with the human being. How else should the human being know what it is that the divine wants? Right? Pretty simple, pretty basic. So every religion, and if you go through in your head all the ones that you know about, has some answer to that question, generally in the form of a prophet. Mormons have their book that was uncovered, buried in a little shack. But there's got to be some form of communication between the divine and the human. Says the Rambam, it is therefore fundamental for the Jews to believe that the words of the prophets are true and that Moshe was the father of all prophets. Why does Moshe have to be the father of all prophets? He's got more of a mission than all of our other prophets because he's the one who's going to communicate to us literally the word of Hashem to us. That it has to be that whatever we're going to get from the divine is going to come through Moshe. Because all the Jewish people watch Moshe go up on Har Sinai and he comes down with this Torah and he's going to teach it to us. And therefore that is going to be a fundamental principle. We're going to talk about this because that's then going to be at the center of our quest tonight. How do we know that this is authentic, that which we have? Because this is our discussion. Moving on for now, number 8 and number 9, I believe with complete faith that the entire Torah now in our hands is the same one that was given to Moshe, our teacher. You also have to know, whatever it is that we have now, when you open up a Sefer Torah in any shul and you read from it, this is the same Torah that was given over 3,300 years ago. Same exact one, and the last of the ones that are relevant to us. I believe with complete faith that the Torah will not be exchanged, nor will there ever be another Torah from the Creator, blessed is He. What we have now is it. Not changing, not ever going to be switched out for something else. We have it in our hands now, exactly as it was given, and it will never be given again in another form, in any other way. Those are the four principles that the Rambam lays out for us as Jews. Number one, that the prophets are true, that the prophecy of Moshe is true, that the Torah that's in our hands is accurate and will never be given again. Okay, let's see if we can prove this. Let's see what we have to be able to verify that indeed all that we have is accurate. One last word of introduction. What we are discussing tonight is at the core of the issues between, in our American Jewish scene, conservative Reform and Orthodox Judaism. This idea of what we call Torah miSinai, the authenticity of Torah directly from Sinai, unchanging, as we have it now, exactly as it was given, and divine in nature, is what defines Orthodoxy. That the Torah that we have is authentic, that it is unchanging, and that it is divine. The other branches of our modern-day American Judaism will play with those in different ways. But that's a defining role of Torah miSinai. As soon as a Jew says there's any element of Torah, now we're going to get to the oral law in another week, and the oral law has the combination of rabbinic input plus divine input, which is much more confusing, and it's going to be much more complex, which is why I did not even dare attempt to get it all into the same class. But when we get through that, but as far as at least the written word goes, there it's much more straightforward, cut and dry, black and white, that it came from a single author, which is a divine author, written by God, transmitted to Moshe, is the bedrock of Orthodoxy. So the question that I'm asking of, how do we know, is a fundamental question. That's one that's certainly at the heart of much, I don't want to use another controversy, but much debate, so to speak, within different streams of Judaism. Okay, ready? Ready? Did I lose you already? Okay, here we go. Section 2. So what are the proofs? What are some of these ideas? Again, none of these are going to be definitive proofs. Let's talk them through. And again, we could spend much time on each one of these, but I want to do them relatively quickly to give you a sense and a taste as opposed to putting you to sleep by discussing any of these for too much of a length of time. Number one is what's known as the Kuzari approach. Now, if you never heard of the Kuzari approach, it's because it's not taught in schools that way. The Kuzari was a book that was written in the 12th century, or 11th century, I should say. It was actually one of, in our great Jewish books course, we discussed this book at length. It was written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who was a sage and a doctor and a poet in 11th century Spain. If you remember our discussions from the Sfarad world versus the Ashkenaz world, the Sfarad world was filled with poetry and mathematics and philosophy. They were very engaged in the world, and the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote a book called the Kuzari, in which he describes a king, the Khazar king, who had a dream, and in his dream a divine being said to him, to the Khazar king, that while your intentions are good, you're trying to serve the divine, the means in which you're doing it are bad, go find a true religion. And so this book describes how this, it's historically debated, if you remember, we discussed this historically, that this actually happened enough. This is how he wrote the book. This king then gathered a Jew and a Christian and a Muslim and had them debate their religions to come to the truth as to what's the true religion. And in that book, he has many philosophical arguments as to the veracity of Judaism. And his basic approach, which I'm going to summarize hundreds of pages, or at least 100 pages, in one small little paragraph, is as follows. And his approach is as follows. It's implausible that an entire generation was duped into believing their own false national history as written in the Torah. Because of the wealth of historical and social history mentioned in the Torah, whose authenticity was verified by the entire Jewish nation, and then transmitted generation after generation. Meaning to say as follows. When was the Torah, this is his classic argument, who receives the Torah? What generation gets this actual book? So there's some Jewish people at some stage in our history who actually have to take upon themselves this book, like every religion. Somebody has to start it. Some people have to be given a book. Because in the book it says, you are being given this book by me, Moshe representing, that's what it says in the book, in order for you to keep. And in this book it says many, many facets of our national history. Like, you just left Egypt. It says in the book, you, the generation who's receiving this book, just left Egypt, where you were enslaved. And you spent 40 years in the desert, where you were fed by this miraculous manna which fell from heaven. So if I were to give you this book, let's say today, let's say none of you are Jewish, and I gave you this book and I said, you guys, you're not going to believe this, you're all family. You're all my family. We're a big tribe. We're living in Atlanta, Georgia, in this wonderful tribe, this city, and I'd like to create a religion, and I want to give you this book, and you'll accept it as truth. And I would give you this book. And you'd read this, okay, I'll read it through. And you read it through, and it says that you and your fathers went through Egypt, and you were slaves, and you were fed in the desert for 40 years. Would you accept this book as truth? You'd say, well, it didn't happen to me. I wasn't ever in Egypt, and my father was never in Egypt. He told me lots of stories, and none of them have to do with being in Egypt. So you give it back to me, and you say, I don't know, this isn't my family. I say, no, it's your family. Don't you remember? You were in Egypt. No, I wasn't. So the Kuzer makes a very simple argument. The book itself, when does it work its way into the world? Some generation has to have taken in this book and said, okay, we'll do this. Now I want to add one major point to this. Is this book, the generation that accepted this book, was accepting this book simple like, I don't know, eating ice cream and jelly beans, or does this book ask a great deal from its adherents? Let me remind everybody about something called Pesach. So whoever's going to accept this book has to be ready to do a lot. So who accepted this book? What generation said, oh, we'll keep Pesach, because my father went through Egypt, even though he never told me anything about it, and he never stepped foot in Egypt in his life, but I'll do that. I'll clear chametz out of my house on Pesach. What generation would do that? So he writes, a book which describes in such detail national history, events which took place to the generation, who would take such a book? Because it describes so much detail. It's impossible to dupe an entire generation into that. So you'd find a family like that. So one family would say, our whole answer, where did everybody go who went through this, that you would take on all the things that are required of you, and you know that none of it took place? So without getting into all the details, he literally describes this for pages and pages. If you're interested in this argument and learning more about it, you can read more about it. But his argument is, there's no point in time that you can get this in. And in the box, I gave you one quote from him under that. The faith of the Jewish people is based on eyewitness testimony and requires neither proof nor demonstration. I don't need to prove it, because what it's based on is the generation that actually left Egypt. The generation that left Egypt passed it on to the next generation, which passed it on to the next generation, because the book that says you left Egypt was given to a people who actually left Egypt. I don't need a proof, The proof is simply eyewitness testimony and requires neither proof nor demonstration because of that. We're going to leave this because we're going to reference this back, this argument. This is one of the, like, those umbrella proofs as we go through a bunch of the others. The other main proof that's offered is what's known as the unique mass revelation claim. Meaning there's a mass revelation that God revealed himself to a mass of people. And I want to introduce this with the following story. It's a Hasidic tale, which, as you know, I like telling Hasidic tales. There was once a Hasidic Rebbe, very big Rebbe, had a large community, a lot of followers, and he had three very capable sons. One son was his eldest son, who certainly by right had the mantle of leadership after his eventual father's death. He had a second son who was by far the greatest scholar, and he had a third son who was by far the most charismatic. And when the father was aging, somebody had to take over the dynasty. And nobody knew which son would it be. Would it be the eldest son? Would it be the scholar? Would it be the charismatic son? And they were all waiting, all of the Hasidim were waiting to hear from the Rebbe which son he was going to appoint, since they were all equally qualified with different traits, who was going to be the next Rebbe. And as good stories go, the Rebbe died before he was able to appoint a son. So the Rebbe dies, and the three sons are all interested in being the next Rebbe, and nobody knows who it should be. So a little bit of time goes by, everybody's trying to figure out, everybody, all the Hasidim are talking, it should be this one, it should be the oldest, it should be the scholar, it should be the charismatic one. Finally, one morning, about 3 months after their father's death, one of the sons comes into the room where his two brothers were sitting, and he said, "I had a dream last night." You're never going to believe this. You're never going to believe this. But this is the way the story goes. I know, you're not going to believe it. He says, "I had a dream last night. And our father came to me in my dream last night and said, I should be the next Rebbe." That's what he said. So, do you believe him? What he said, "My father, can you prove that he's wrong? Can you prove that he's right?" So he said, "Listen, guys. I can't prove that I'm right. I mean, I know that I had this dream. I can't prove it. But you can't prove that I'm wrong. So in the meanwhile, I'll take over as the Rebbe, and if you come up with a proof that it didn't really happen, so we'll see." So what do you think about that? No. So what's the real argument against him? It's his word again, but what's the real argument? Better than that. So say it in words. Yes. If Abba came to one of us, in other words, none of the boys were questioning the validity of a dream, but if Dad wanted to communicate his desire, he should have come to us and say, "You are going to be the next Rebbe." That's in concrete terms. All of you intuitive, "Oh, that's a joke. I'm not going to believe that story." It's true, and you shouldn't believe such a story. Meaning when someone comes and says, "I had a dream." But there's got to be the concrete reason why not is because the same father who has the ability to communicate in dreams, then he can communicate to all of us in dreams. And if he really wanted you to be the next Rebbe, then we're the ones he should have communicated to, not you alone. That's a very important logical reason. Because, as we said, all religions have to have some form of communication between the divine and the human being. That communication is, in essence, going to do what to the rest of the human beings? It's going to force you to do a lot of different things. So you can make an argument, well, if God wants me to keep Pesach, why is he telling me to tell you to keep Pesach? What should he do? Tell you to keep Pesach. So you say, "Well, yeah, I'm on a much higher level than you. I mean, you're just regular plebeian types of people. God's not going to communicate to you. You need me in order to get that." So what if I make that argument? And I say, "I'm the only one holy enough to communicate with the divine, and you therefore have to believe in me because you're not on such a level." Wouldn't work for the Jews, for sure not. Well, you're not going to believe this. It's worked for over 4 billion people who are alive today. It's worked very well for them. But as you said, that wouldn't go with us. No way. No way. But really? I should listen to you? So how does God solve this problem? See, Salah's in a way that no other religion claims. And this is one of the most fundamental truths that we have that no one else has ever dared claim because it's impossible. That's what's known as the mass revelation. When we stood at the foot of Har Sinai, 3 million people, men, women, and children, 7 weeks removed from slavery in Egypt, God reveals Himself to the entirety of the nation. That which the eye couldn't see, the eye saw with the thunder and the lightning, a vision of God. And it's described in the Torah itself. You all saw me, and you all saw me communicating with Moshe. So that it says in the book, all of you saw that. No other religion claims anything close to that, in which there's a mass revelation. It goes through the major religions of the world. How many people were around when Jesus claims to have become a prophet? How many people? 12 at best? I mean, I don't know, there's also a couple here, and maybe it's 12 disciples. How many people is the entire religion resting upon that there is some communication between the divine and the human being now becomes a prophet? Upon how many human beings are we relying on? Not a lot. I'm saying in Christianity, it's not a lot. And it was all recorded over 100 years after all that took place. Islam. Who's the main prophet? We have Muhammad. And how many people are around who saw him communicating with the divine? Nobody. Nobody. He comes down and he says, I had a prophecy. I mean, if you go through the Mormons, it gets even more interesting. You have a single individual who claims that an angel came to him and showed him where there's some buried tablets with some prophecies written on them that he won't allow anyone else to see, that he transcribes, and that the angel takes away. And then he says he got it back again, and then he brings two other people to witness that he actually had them, and then they disappear and they're never seen again. And then you have an entire religion of people who are believing everything that's written, but upon how many people are they believing the communication between the divine and the human? So again, it's one person. It's on one person. No other religion can come close to claiming that there was a mass of people, not just mass of 100, several million who saw Moshe being spoken to by God Himself. They themselves, the Torah records, heard two of the Ten Commandments, but they all saw the communication. They saw, as prophets see, God communicating with mankind. Now that's significant for a couple of reasons. A, because of the fact that you have masses of people. But two, because the people that are going to then keep the word of this book are going to receive a book that says, you, the people who received this book, saw with your eyes how I communicated with Moshe. Would you ever listen to a book that said that you saw with your own eyes God communicating with the prophet who's telling you what to do if you didn't see it? That's what it says in the book. It says, you yourself saw how I communicated with Moshe. 3 million of you all saw that. So because of the fact that nobody else can make such a claim, it becomes a significant thing. What's the difference between legend, for example, and history? Anybody here ever hear of George Washington? Very good, very good. Anyone here ever heard of George Washington's cherry tree? Show of hands. Who's heard of that story? How many people believe, keep your hands up for a second. How many people believe that story to be true? A lot of hands went down. Like, I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. So I have a question. How can it be? How many of you think, is there an American alive today who's older than, I don't know, 15, 16, 20, who has not heard of that story? It's part of American culture. But not all of you believe it's true, right? So how can you, what's the difference between history and, like, you all believe China exists. You all believe there's such a thing called the Black Plague, but you don't believe that George Washington actually had a cherry tree that belonged to his father, that he chopped down, and when his father questioned him, he said, I cannot tell a lie, I did it. You don't really believe that to be true. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it's not, but I don't know. Would you change your life because of that story? Are you willing to bet your life that it really happened? I wouldn't. But we're willing to bet our life that Shabbos is real, and that kosher is real, and Pesach is real. So what's the difference? Lots of people believe this story, or at least say over this story. So what's the difference between a legend and history? So this gets back to numbers. At the end of the day, what are you resting the belief on whether or not the story is true or not? What are you resting it on? An eyewitness account. And then once one person told it, maybe it spread. Even if it spread to millions and millions and millions of people, but at the end of the day, what are you resting its laurels on? That one person was there and said that it happened. After that, the story might spread, but now it's just a story that's spreading. How do I know if it's truth that's spreading? No idea. I have no idea. I could tell a good story, and if you guys really like it, you'll tell some more people, and they might tell some more people, and before you know it, we can have a real story, but I made it up, and you're just repeating my story. Except if 3 million people saw the story, and the story says that 3 million people saw the story, then that's harder to pass on a story that everybody was there when the people who are spreading that story weren't there. And that all comes down to, in a brief synopsis, this concept of the mass revelation. That there was a concept that many, 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 millions of people all saw that, and no one else can claim that, and the significance of what comes out of that. Comments, questions? Okay, let's move on. Then we have another aspect called the internal affirmation through mitzvah observance. And that is the idea which is the continued observance of the Jewish people testifies to the Torah's truth. An example that we've used before, and I'm going to use it again, is the concept of Pesach. Did you guys keep Pesach last Nisan, last April? So say yes. Okay, the year before that? 10 years before that? 100 years before that? The Jewish people keep it 200 years ago. 500. When did it start? It started Pesach time, probably. Right, when the Jews left Egypt, that's when it started. So there's this concept that the continued observance goes back to an event, and this goes back to, again, points 1 and 2. Because you can say, well, Christianity celebrates certain holidays, so when there are like billions of people doing that, well, when did that start? So you go back, well, when did it start? Okay, let's just take the nativity scene. So they're all celebrating, what's that, Easter, Christmas? I don't remember, I don't have Christmas. So you say, well, they're going to celebrate Christmas, so billions of people around the world are going to do this. Well, when did that start? So you go all the way back to what event? Okay, how many people were there that can say that what they're now, that event, that's the starting point, that we know it's real? Four, is it? I don't know. Four? Six? Whatever it was. And when was it recorded? Was it recorded at that moment for everybody else? Did they celebrate the following year? So at the end of the day, you get back to a point in which you have lots of people following a story, and then at its core, how do you know when it happened? Well, you're taking the word of a very small number of people that something happened. So you go back to Pesach. Well, when did that start? How many people were there? So is it logical that you can dupe the amount of people necessary about an event that claims the amount of people were involved and have them buy into cleaning their house for Pesach because of that? So as someone said, not the Jews. No way. No way. I want to read you a piece from the Ramban, Nachmanides. It's a beautiful piece. The Ramban writes as follows. There are many commandments on the top of the second page of the notes. There are many commandments that are in remembrance of the Exodus of Egypt. If you ever pay attention, how many times we say that phrase? Zecher li yitzias Mitzrayim. Zecher li yitzias Mitzrayim. We say that phrase so many times. Not just Pesach time. All the time. In remembrance of the Exodus of Egypt. Why do we do so many things, says the Ramban? Because they are all to be for us in all generations testimony that the wonders will not be forgotten, so that there should not be an opportunity for a denier to deny belief in God. That's why we do them. Because the generation that left Egypt did it, and then the next generation did it, and then the next generation did it. And they all say, this is to remind us of the events that took place. There's a beautiful phrase here. One who buys a mezuzah for one coin, a couple bucks, you buy a mezuzah. By fixing it on his doorpost and having the proper intent for what it means, acknowledges his belief in the renewal of the world, of his acknowledge of God, his providence, prophecy, and that he believes in all aspects of the Torah, as well as acknowledging the greatness of God's kindness upon those who fulfill his will, and that he redeemed us from slavery. You put up a mezuzah, that's what you're saying. I believe in the creation of the world by putting up this mezuzah, because this mezuzah represents the parshios, the paragraphs that are written in there, the Exodus of Egypt. When I put this on my doorpost, I am testifying to the fact that there is a Creator who took the Jewish people out of Egypt. And that my father did that, and his father did that, and his father did that, all the way back to the time when the Jewish people rendezvoused with God Himself at the Exodus of Egypt. And everything that we do brings us back to that. I have in the notes, we're living in a generation now that's tasked with remembering the Holocaust. And this is a classic example that really brings home what it is that we're talking about. I'm a grandchild of survivors. My grandfather, Zichron Levracha, and my grandmother, Yibadlu L'chaim, she should live and be well, went through the camps. My mother's mother, Zichron Levracha, went through, had to escape and lost all of her family. How do I know the Holocaust is true? How do I know it's true? I don't know if it's true. My grandparents, who I spent the first 35 years of my life growing up in their homes, they lived it. I don't need a proof that it happened. I don't have to go to a museum. I don't have to hear a lecture. I don't have to go to the Greenwood Cemetery on Yom HaShoah. I know that it's true because I lived it. I didn't live through it. I lived with grandparents who went through it. How are my children going to know that it's true? How are my children, who my older children remember my grandparents, the younger children won't? How are they going to know that it's true? For me. Well, what am I going to do to make sure that they know that it's true? Right? So, I tell them. And what else can I do besides to tell them? Right? We'll do that. Let's say we would go to the museum every year on Yom HaShoah, and we would say, this is the day that acknowledges that my grandparents went through this event. So you ritualize it. You do something that doesn't. If you're just relying on me to tell stories, so you know I might be a decent storyteller. But what about the guy next to me who's not a good storyteller or doesn't want to talk about it? So how do I make sure that my children know that it's true? I have firsthand experience. So I'm going to take them, and we'll do something on Yom HaShoah that will. The reason why we're doing this today is because of your great grandparents who I knew went through this. And then what are they going to do? So it says the Ramban, when you put a mezuzah up on your door, that's what you're doing. Because who's the first generation that put the mezuzah up on their door? The generation that went through Egypt, that received the Torah in the desert. They got that mitzvah of mezuzah, which says in there, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, that says in there, I took you out of Egypt with an outstretched hand. And when you put that mezuzah up on your door, we are the embodiment of that next generation and the next generation and the next generation. Because guess what happens in the generation after the actual events? Then you have people who say, that never really happened. Prove it. Prove that it happened. So we're already living in a generation of significant people who deny the Holocaust. Absurd as it is, 70 years later, with survivors still alive today, dwindling, but alive today, there is a large number of people in this world who believe the whole thing was made up. Now we feel like, it's absurd, right? But they're there. Guess who's going to get stronger 10 years from now? Those of us who believe it happened, or those who don't believe that it happened? No question about it, right? The farther away that we get, the more people who right now, the generation today says, well, for sure it's real. 20 years from now, we'll be much more inclined to say, I don't know. I don't know anybody who went through it. Maybe they made it up. So how do you keep that up? How do you make sure that it always is part of our existence? Says the Ramban, well, that's what we're doing with Mitzrayim. How are we keeping it up? Every time, every mitzvah you do, every time you say that phrase, Zechil Yetzias Mitzrayim, we, 3,300 years later, are continuing that story that started. It's a family story. This happened to my great-grandfather. And we tell it over from one generation to the next. And the Ramban says, how do you know this is true? Because we're still doing it. How are my great-grandchildren, God willing one day I'll have great-great-grandchildren, how are they going to know the Holocaust is true? Because they'll have heard from my grandchildren, who will have heard from my children, who will have heard from me, who will have seen my grandfather. That's us. Every time you keep Pesach, every time you put a mezuzah up on your door, you're testifying all the way back to the generation that actually was there. just to finish up the Ramban, this is what the sages say, the second paragraph. This is why our sages say one should be as particular regarding a seemingly insignificant mitzvah as he would be with a severe one, because all mitzvahs are desired and beloved, because through their performance a person acknowledges God. The intention of all mitzvahs that we should believe in Him and thank Him for creating us, and this is the intention of all creation, that humankind recognizes the presence of God. And that's what we're doing with all of our mitzvahs, bringing us back to the point in which we acknowledge His existence, which is really all through the Pesach story, but we're not going to get too much into Pesach right now. Moving along, letter D, just to finish up the last three concepts. How do you know it's true? Well, because there are a lot of prophecies in the Torah that prophesize about future events. If you read through the Torah, the five books, there are many comments about things that will happen in the future. Meaning to the generation that receives this book, they're told about things that will happen, and they do. For example, you're going to spend 40 years in the desert. You're going to enter, conquer, and divide the land of Canaan. You will then fail. You'll be destroyed. You'll be exiled. You'll be filled with lots of what we call today anti-Semitism. You'll remain few in numbers, yet you'll always survive, keep the Torah, and eventually return. I could list about all those things off. And say, yeah, I know. We've all seen that. We've lived through that. But it says it in the book about things which hadn't yet happened, like the exile. We're talking about a book which ends with the Jewish people on the cusp of entering into the land of Israel. And that book describes, as we read every year, you're going to enter into this land, you're going to get fat with good, you're going to forget about me, you're not going to observe the Torah, and I'm going to exile you. You're going to be scattered throughout the land. You're going to be few in number, but you'll never be fully destroyed, and you'll never forget the Torah, and then eventually you'll come back. And all these things are described. And then they happen. In your packets, if you want to read through this, there's a whole section here, which I'm not going to go through, but if you're interested, you can. I believe it begins on page 5, in which 5, 6, 7, they go through at length this idea, 5, 6, and 7, in which you can take a prophecy, a simple prophecy that says when the exile happens, you're going to be exiled by a nation that you don't speak their language, there's going to be a number of you that are going to be brought back to Egypt on ships, you'll be scattered, you're not going to have your own government, and eventually you'll return. And if you go through the four or five steps that the Torah describes, and you put numbers on them, you say, how likely is it that somebody could have predicted this event? Was it normal for a conquering nation in the times of the Torah to completely annihilate and destroy its victims? Was that normal? So they go through it. No, it wasn't. Because why were most wars fought in those days? For land and for money. You didn't want to destroy the people. If you destroyed the people, then you couldn't tax them. So it wasn't the most common thing to totally annihilate somebody. Would you scatter them throughout the world? Is that what you do with people you conquered? Not necessarily. How likely was it that the conquering nation didn't speak your language and was a language that you didn't understand? It goes through the numbers percentage-wise. You put all the things together and you say, well, how likely is this event to have happened? They come up with a number. It's 1 in 16,000 or 64,000 are the numbers that you can read it inside. You put all the prophecies like that together and you say, like, well, the things that the Torah predicts, are they likely or unlikely? And then what's the probability when you put them all together that they actually take place? I'll give you the notes if you're interested in reading about that. You could do that more. The last one I just want to say on that is the last prophecy that we have that we're literally living through right now is the eventual return. We are literally experiencing now, and this is something that I've spoken about many times, because we need to stop and think about it for a second, of the fact that the Torah records that there's going to be an exile, there's going to be a scattering, and you're going to come home. There has never been a people in the history of the world who have been exiled from their land for over 2,000 years who came home. There's no model for this. It's never existed that a people has been scattered, that they've maintained their identity without a homeland, and then they came back. It's unheard of. Not only has it been unheard of, it was predicted is going to happen. And we're literally watching it happen now. We're almost at about 50% of world Jewry is back in the land of Israel. There are more Jews living in Israel now than during the times of the Second Temple. We have a country, we have a government, we have a currency, we have an army. It's not perfect, as we've discussed many times, but we're literally watching prophetic visions unfold, which could never have been predicted. Nobody could have ever predicted, no human being would put in a book, I want you to tell you something that's going to happen. I'm going to give you this book. You're not going to listen. I'm going to scatter you. You'll be exiled for a really long time, and you're going to come back. They're not the types of prophecies that you would have the audacity to say anything about. And the Torah says it, and we're watching it happen. for all of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who can only yearn of seeing it being fulfilled, we're watching it happen, literally watching it unfold in front of our eyes. And for those who need proof to the veracity of the Torah, really need look no further than the fact that the Jewish people are returning to the land of Israel. And the reason why I stress this is because we take it for granted. Because we're growing up, okay, it's already been 60-some-odd years that we have the state of Israel, the Jews are back. Okay, we got problems. We're so consumed with the problems, and there are real problems. Problems from the outside, and all sorts of terrorist issues which we know we need to deal with. We got problems internally. There are lots of problems. I'm aware of all of them. But what happens is we get blinded by the problems and forget about the fact that what's happening in front of our eyes is unfathomable. It's unfathomable. And it's happening. And that's part of the Torah actually says things which no person could have possibly predicted, which leads us to the next two things that I want to mention. There are mitzvahs which reflect the divine nature. If you were, you know, our question of the night is, how do we know that this is authentic? How do we know that this is divine? Well, would any human dare say the following thing? Shemitah, every 7 years you leave your land fallow. Every 50th year you leave your land fallow for 2 consecutive years. So you're a human being writing a book and you want people to follow your religion. You're thinking, okay, well, what kind of law should I come up with? Okay, maybe you would come up with the idea of Shabbos as a nice day, a day of rest. That's fine. Maybe you would have come up with some of these other things, kosher, diet, maybe. Do you think any human being would have come up with the following idea? Okay, I want all my adherents to leave your land fallow every 7 years. And then every 50th year, leave it fallow for 2 consecutive years. And if you ask me, what are we going to eat? Don't worry about it. It's on me. I'll take care of you. Take care of you. Would you follow such a book? Say, well, that makes a lot of sense. Sure, I'll do that. And yet, that's literally what we find. 6 years you shall sow your field, and the seventh year will be a Sabbath rest. And if you shall say, well, what are we going to eat the seventh year? We can't gather something to eat. I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. You will sow in the 8th, and still eat of the old crop until the 9th, until its crop comes in, you should go. Can you imagine someone saying that? Who would dare? Why? Why would anyone even put that in your book that says, I want you to leave it fallow for a while, and don't worry about it. I'll take care of you. For 3 years' time, your crops will produce all that you need. Or the law of Yontif, Shalosh Regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos. Where does everybody go? Yerushalayim. What if you have a really nice house out in Petach Tikva, and your whole family picks up? Oh, not just your family, the whole block. No, not the whole block, the whole neighborhood. Yeah, the whole neighborhood, the whole town picks up and leaves for a week, and there are a couple of young mothers with nursing babies who say, we're going to stay behind this year. Okay, sure. So the whole town leaves, and there are a couple of women with nursing babies back home, just a ghost town. So, you know, we have some neighbors just a few miles to the north and to the east of us, some other nations that live there, and they've picked up on this pattern that every single year, for a week's time, the entire town deserts, leaving it completely open. Would you follow that book? And what if I told you in the book it says, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of you. Nothing is going to happen. Would you dare say that? Torah says it. And we're living already without Yerushalayim, without a Beis HaMikdash, so we don't do it. But for every year that the Beis HaMikdash stood, hundreds of years, the entire country deserts. And it's not a secret. Like we have, you know, we're just trying to get the nations of the world to figure out to do our timing of our lights for Yom Tov. Like Shabbos we get every 7 days. But we need the lights to be on a rotation. When it's Yom Tov, we can't push the button. So it's not a secret to them. We give them a calendar. This is when it's going to come out. And they know what exactly Yom Tov is going to be. Okay, so the times of the base of Mikdash was a base and it wasn't exact. Everybody knew pretty much when Pesach was going to be, year after year after year after year after year. No problems? Ever? No looting? No ransacking? There's no problems. Who could say that? Another element is the fact that the Torah puts into place numerous different mitzvahs that no human would dare come up with, because it's impossible to even attempt to keep it, carry it through, that which you're going to say. Torah is uniquely honest and self-critical. As a book, most historical books, if you're going to fudge history, in which way do you fudge it? To make yourself look good or to make yourself look bad? So we generally find histories as in the favor of the one writing it. That the person or the nation that's writing it presents themselves in the best light. If you were to look at the Torah as a human written book describing the Jewish people, right, how do you think it makes us look?
Not too good.
Right, not too good. Almost the opposite of what you would expect. Really what the Torah fills itself with is actually all of the problems that we learn to fix ourselves rather than what you would almost have expected. We find a real, honest, self-critical look at the leaders of the Jewish people throughout whatever the Torah is talking about, from Avram all the way down to Moshe. We're told about the mistakes, which is a uniquely honest and self-critical concept. You find the survival of the Jewish people. You want to know, how do you know the Torah is true? Well, the biggest proof to the fact that the Torah is true is the fact that you and I are standing here today. At the end of the day, that is, it just speaks for itself. Because if you think about what we've been through, there is no nation that can possibly have survived what we've been through. There's a piece which I'm sure that I've quoted here many times. Whenever we have high schools or elementary schools or religious seminaries, they come because we're a big shul here, so a lot of the non-Jewish groups like to come visit the shul. So they set up appointments, they come, they bring their classes. We've had from sixth grade, high school, post-high school. And they like to have a little talk with me, Judaism 101, but with like a real live Jew, like to actually see a Jew in his home cage, like we're in a synagogue, and they look around, and it's like really, it's fascinating. So we have a little talk, and I almost always quote for them what you have in your packets on page 11, which is a quote from Mark Twain. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but it is worth it, because if the purpose of tonight is to say, well, how do we know that this is really true? This says it all. Mark Twain, concerning the Jew, Harper's Magazine, in March of 1898, writes as follows. If statistics are right, we are but 1% of the human race, a nebulous, dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of. This is 1898. He ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of, is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. Mark Twain is writing in 1898. Who knows when did the Nobel Prize system start? Anyway? I believe it's 1903. Since 1903, there have been approximately 800 Nobel Prizes awarded to in various art, literature, peace, all those different things. What percentage of the Jew are the population of the Jews? Pretty small, like 0.2%. So out of 800, let's round it up to 1,000, just for argument's sake. Out of 1,000 Nobel Prizes given over the last 100 years, this is after Mark Twain, and I don't need to tell you that this century has been pretty bad for the Jews, right? In World War I, World War II, it's been a disaster. In this century, which has not been a good century for the Jews, and I would venture to say, as you know them want to say, it has been the worst century. And this one is really true. The 20th century is by far the worst century for the Jewish people since the destruction of the temple. Just sheer numbers. 6 million is unfathomable. The fact that I can even talk about it that way just tells us how numb we've become to the numbers. But in this century, that was the most disastrous century in Jewish history. Out of the, let's call it an even 1,000 Nobel Prizes, 0.2% of the population, how many prizes should we have taken home? Just statistically speaking.
None.
Two. 0.2% out of 1,000 would be two. We should have taken two. We are about 15 million people. 15 million people. How many Chinese are there in the world? 1.4 billion. How many Muslims? Also about 1.4 billion. I'm sure I quote this before, but I tell this to the students, they love it. Out of 1.4 billion Chinese, so how do you count that many people? Or you laugh. I mean, you do a census, it's really hard. 1.4 billion is enormous. So anytime you do a census, I've said this before, right? Anytime you do a census, there is a margin of error. What's the margin of error? It's about 1.8%. What's 1.8% margin of error on a 1.4 billion count of Chinese? What's the margin of error? It's about 25 million. That means there are more Chinese people missing in the world that we can't find than there are Jews. Think about that for a moment. When they do a census of the Chinese, there are more Chinese people that they just throw up their hands and say, I don't know, maybe they're here, maybe they're not, we don't know, than there are Jews in the whole world. That's how many 1.4 billion is. 15 million. How many Nobel Prizes have the Chinese people won over the last 100 years? 1.4 billion? 11. 11. Muslims? 1.4 billion? 6. And one of them was for terrorists who stopped killing Jews. So let's call it 5. How many of the Jews won? 15 million? In our worst century ever, 0.2% of the population? Ready for this? 180. 180 out of the 800 from Jews, Mark Twain writes, way out of proportion to their numbers, their contribution to the world, art, science, mathematics, peace, you name it, in numbers, just statistically speaking, in a century that was a disaster for us, in that century, to produce 180 Nobel Prize winners, at 15 million people, when populations, what the number is, 10, 20, 100 times our size, 6 and 11. That is as Mark Twain writes. Then he asks Mark Twain. He says, look at this marvelous fight in all ages, and he's done it with his hands tied behind him. Meaning, throughout, again, he's running in the late 1800s. We've been persecuted. We've been left out of every incident. Why were all the Jews bankers in the Middle Ages? Because we weren't allowed to do anything else. That's why. He's done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and excuse all of any right. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor and faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek, the Roman followed, made a vast noise, and they are all gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Could not write a more beautiful piece than Mark Twain, who was not a lover of the Jews, but who could not figure it out. How is it possible that this people who have been persecuted, who have had their hands tied behind their backs, who have had nothing but sorrows, and yet they contribute in ways well beyond their means, they should have disappeared, they don't. Why? How? What's the secret of their immortality? When I do this with my students, the visiting schools, I always ask them this question. I say, so new, what's the answer to Mark Twain's kasha? What's the answer to this question? Mark Twain can't figure out the secret of immortality. Do you know the answer? So you know what they say? They say it's because the Jews love each other. They're like one. No, that's not the answer to our immortality. No way. And then they say, Jews value education. Oh, yeah, that's why. Because we value education, that's our secret. And I say, no, it's not true. That's not true. And they come up with one or two other things. And they say, you know, there's a day school down the road. Every single child in that school from the age of kindergarten and up knows the answer to Mark Twain's question. He can't figure it out, but every single child in that school knows the answer to this question. Do you think you know it now? And they're going, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Tell us. And the answer is, of course, it's what's behind that ark. When the Jews take out that Sefer Torah and they hold the Torah in their hands, they're literally holding a piece of immortality itself. They're holding God Himself, His will, His ratzon, His desire for them. And when they hold on to that Torah, they're literally holding on to it. And Mark Twain saw it, but couldn't understand it. Couldn't figure it out, but he observed it. Something is different about these people that doesn't make any sense. Because they shouldn't be here. Not only should they not be here, but even if they're here, they certainly can't be contributing anything to the world. And not only are they here, not only are they contributing, they've watched every power rise to prominence and disappear. And there's one constant. It's just the Jew. He's the constant throughout world history. As you flip the pages in your world history book, the names, the places, the people change, and there's one constant, the Jews watching him all, being beaten down by him all, but outliving them all, showing no infirmities of age, no weakening of his alert and aggressive mind. What's the secret? Ladies and gentlemen, those who are not sure of the validity or authenticity of the Torah need look no further than Mark Twain. Because something about us is different. And it wouldn't be different if what we're following was made up of a bunch of different human authors throughout the period. You can't explain this without the divine nature. Yeah? Right, always out of proportion. Always that way. Yeah. Yeah, I get interesting reactions. You know, I always I share with them. I don't know what they're thinking inside. I've heard from many of the teachers afterwards. They say, "Wow, you know, we really liked your presentation. It created a lot of interesting dialogue on our bus on the way home." That's for sure. That's for sure. But again, especially for the Christians, because their whole belief system is that we were certainly the chosen people. It's just that we have been superseded. You should know, by the way, your question is a real question. The church itself had to deal with this problem. The church itself in the Middle Ages assumed that since Christianity had come onto the scene and become so powerful, by definition, the Jew should disappear. And the Jew didn't disappear. And it was a theological problem for the church why the Jew was still around. And those of you, some of you are probably familiar with, so they created a concept called the witness people, in which they came up with the idea, it must be that God is keeping a pocket of Jews alive in order to witness that they were wrong and give us praise and say, Christianity is true. Because if all the Jews would disappear, then there'd be nobody around to say, we were right. So they came up with a theological answer to that and to say, the reason why they're not disappearing is because God needs them. And therefore the Pope actually had in Rome the Pope's Jews, which were protected by papal authority, to protect them, that they should be around to be able to witness the greatest Christianity. But it's been a long-standing theological problem. The fact that we're still around today and the fact that Jews are returning to Israel, all of that's very theologically challenging. That's why a certain Christian groups say, we need them to come back in order for the next coming of Jesus. That's why they're supportive. It's a theologically complex issue and not the topic of our conversation tonight. One last point I'll mention tonight before we conclude, and that is the uniformity of the Torah scrolls worldwide. The concept of, you talk about the authenticity, we have this phenomena of over 2,000 years of exile, 3,000 years since it's been given, and you can go to any synagogue in the world and open up their Aron Kodesh and take out a Sefer Torah, and what will you find? Same. It is a feat that is so unfathomable over such a long period of time, so many different countries, so many different exiles, that this scroll would maintain itself in Yemen, which was one country which was outside of the circle of the Jewish world. They found 9 differences out of the whole thing, 9, and they were all just in spellings, none of them that affected any of the meaning. And all that comes to the rigorous way in which the Torah scroll is transcribed. It always has to be transcribed from a pre-existing Torah scribe. It always has to be transcribed with the scribe who says out of the word. It's double-checked. The fact that we've maintained that, when did it start? What's the origin? Where did it all come from? So you just, again, one of those points, you keep going back. The Medrash actually says, that's the last thing on your sheet. The sages said, since Moshe knew that he was to die on that day, this is the last day of his life. So what did he do? So Rabbi Yonai the sage says, he wrote 13 copies of the Torah, 12 he gave to the 12 tribes, and 1 he put in the ark. So that if one would want to make a false change in the text, there would always be a copy in the ark against which the change could be verified. And that has proven itself throughout literally centuries in which it's still the same. So I leave you tonight with what I started with is, no one thing that I said tonight was aimed at being able to say without a shadow of a doubt, this is the truth. But when you put everything together, you look at all the evidence, You look at our existence. You look at the validity of the Torah scroll itself, the authenticity, the fact that it's still the same. You look at the types of mitzvahs that are described in the Torah. You look at the historical facts. You look at the prophecies. You look at the fact that there was a people that accepted a book that says they themselves were in mass all there. And you say, I might not have been to China, but I know that China can't be a made-up place. It's just too much evidence that all points to the same direction. In the same sense, none of us were there 3,300 years ago, but we all have fathers and parents who handed us the tradition, who kept Pesach, and we kept Pesach, and they kept Pesach. And Kevin, I'll leave you with one last story. The great Chassidish Rebbe, Mibarditzev, Rabbi Yitzchak Levi from Mibarditzev, once came in on Pesach night. I've told a lot of Pesach stories. Came on a Pesach night, Leil Seder, and after davening he said, Rabbi Yisai, to his chassidim, we cannot start the Seder until I have Turkish tea. I need 5 pounds of Turkish tea. Turkish tea in Tsarist Russia was an illegal contraband. He said, I need 5 pounds of it before we can start the Seder tonight. And his chassidim said, Rebbe, penalty of death, you're not allowed to have Turkish tea. He said, we're not starting the Seder until I get 5 pounds of it. See, them all went home. They said, the Rebbe needs 5 pounds of Turkish tea. And within an hour, 5 pounds show up at the Rebbe's door. Said, Rabbi Shai, I need, and he quoted something else that was illegal by the Russians. They said, Rebbe, wait. We can't start. Everybody goes home. Within an hour, lo and behold, everybody's got it. He says, one last thing, we can't start until I need a piece of bread. They said, Rebbe, it's Pesach. He said, Rabbi Yisai, we're not starting until I have a piece of bread. He said, who has bread? He said, I'm telling you, we're not starting. They said, Rebbe, there is not a home in Barditzer with a morsel of bread in it. Nothing. He said, Rebbeinu Shalom, we live in Russian Tsarist Russia under penalty of death where there are hundreds of police officers everywhere. Real threats. Whatever they made illegal, within an hour I got whatever I need. You told your people, no bread on Pesach. There's not a single security guard. There's not a single police officer. No one's ever seen you face to face. And in Barditchev, there's not a single morsel of bread to be found. Mika Amcha Yisrael, who is like the Jewish people? And that is indeed the secret to our survival and the greatest proof of the authenticity of what it is that we're doing. The system is such that the Jewish people have kept it from year to year to year to year to year because my father wouldn't lie to me. And his father wouldn't lie to him. And his father didn't lie to him all the way back to when the Jews actually left Egypt with the outstretched hand of God showing the way. Have a great night, everyone.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.